I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ask teachers and parents about No Child Left Behind, and chances are they will give you an earful about too much high-stakes testing. Last week, President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, that makes some significant changes in education policy, including shifting more control of public schools to the states and away from the federal government. There still will be math and reading tests, but evaluations will include more than just numerical scores. And the Department of Education won't have the same power to punish schools where students are underperforming. Today on Radio Times, we want to focus on how ESSA is different from No Child Left Behind and what it hopes to accomplish. And we begin our conversation with Allison Klein. She's a reporter for Education Week, where she covers federal policy and Congress, also the co-author of the blog Politics K-12. Allison Klein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
How much debate in Congress? I see that the Senate passed this 85-12. The president very quickly signed this act into law. Was there a lot of debate, much fanfare about this new law?
So on the day that it passed, I mean, the congressional debate was really what we call a love fest. I mean, with everybody congratulating each other. But remember, this law, No Child Left Behind, was up for reauthorization back in 2007. So you could say this happened quickly, or you could say it took 8 years.
And what is the major difference? Is it really shifting a lot of the control and responsibility that goes with that control from the federal government to each state?
Yes, that's the main thrust of the law. There's going to be the federal footprint would shrink dramatically under ESSA. States and districts would have a lot more say when it comes to school turnarounds, how much tests should count for accountability purposes, and how to evaluate teachers.
And there, as I said in my introduction, lots of criticisms of No Child Left Behind. There is still testing under ESSA, yes?
Yes, the tests themselves don't go away. So we would still continue, we will still continue to test students in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. But states will have a lot more control over just how much those tests count towards a school's rating. So they can bring in other factors like school climate, teacher engagement, student engagement, parent engagement, whether students have access to advanced coursework. So all of those things could become part of a school's, the overall picture of a school, as opposed to just a test score, which is the big criticism of NCLB.
And how would a state know about something like parent or teacher or student engagement?
So those are pretty new factors, right? So it's states and districts will have to develop tools to measure those things. It's a great question that you just asked. One potential tool would be surveys, student or parent surveys. There are some folks who are worried that that will kind of water down accountability, that it's too everybody's going to say that their school is great and it won't really give us a true picture of the school.
And that these evaluations have a degree of subjectivity, I would assume.
Yes, absolutely. Right now I would say it's just a concern because this is a new area. It's a totally new territory for accountability. So, right now, we can't really say, hey, this isn't working, because we really haven't seen it rolled out in any kind of big way yet.
And talking about testing, why did testing become so associated with No Child Left Behind?
So No Child Left Behind was the first federal law to require annual tests in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. Before that, some states were testing annually, although not most of them. So that's why No Child Left Behind became so synonymous with tests, because it was really the first law that called for yearly testing. Even though many states were moving in that direction, this was the first time the federal government said you must test. And ESSA doesn't change that, as we've said before. The tests stay in place.
I was also reading, though, that, and I know from parents whose children are in public schools, that they spend days on actual testing. And do the tests largely come from states? Are they coming from the federal government? Why? I mean, one can understand an annual test, but it seems like there are more than just annual tests.
Sure. So the Council of Chief State School Officers and the Council of the Great City Schools, two groups that represent states and districts, have taken a close look at how much testing there is at the state and district level. And it's true that a lot of the tests that parents are concerned about aren't these federally required tests, but tests that states and districts are asking for themselves. And the bill does include language that would encourage states and districts to kind of take a look at the other tests that they're asking students to complete and decide if there's maybe some tests that are redundant, maybe low quality. So we'll see how many states and districts decide to really take on that challenge.
Now, part of No Child Left Behind was to tie teacher evaluations to some of these test scores. What does ESSA do about that?
So that requirement was actually part of the No Child Left Behind waivers. It's hard to keep all of this straight.
It sure is.
In 2011, the Obama administration offered states flexibility from No Child Left Behind in exchange for taking on certain things. And one of the things they had to take on was teacher evaluation through test scores. So it was a part of the administration's this administration's vision for No Child Left Behind, but it's not part of the original law.
Is it part of ESSA?
Go
ahead.
Having said that, though, the ESSA is very clear that you do not need to evaluate teachers through test scores. Many folks say that experiment didn't work out so well. It was a really hard thing to craft to begin with. And then also teachers felt, you know, like there's a lot more to their practice than just growth on test scores. So ESSA leaves that up to states, whether they want to continue with that practice or not.
Is there some reference, though, to teacher accountability, or is that just something that states can decide for themselves?
That's going to be largely up to states under ESSA.
And what about some of these struggling schools, some of them, of course, failing schools, but many of them struggling schools with students who struggle in education? I think there is some worry that they will be left behind as No Child Left Behind has disappeared.
Yes, there's definitely some concern about that right now. State chiefs are very clear right now that they are not going to back down on accountability for struggling schools and traditionally struggling groups of students like English language learners, students in special education, students who are poor. But it is definitely a concern that civil rights advocates have. The bill does have a requirement, though, that states and districts turn around and intervene in their absolute lowest performing schools and schools where where only two-thirds of the kids graduate. So there are some measures in place that would require a state to intervene in certain kinds of schools.
And I guess intervene could be state takeover, charters. I'm just thinking of all the options that a state might have.
Sure. So they have to use some sort of an evidence-based intervention, so something with research to back it up. It could be turning it into a charter, could be closing down the school. It could be putting in place a new curriculum and giving the teachers, some training, some new professional development. States would have broad discretion over what those kinds of interventions would look like, but they would have to do something.
Now, No Child Left Behind went into effect, 2002? And actually expired 5 years later, but nonetheless, whatever has been left of the system has continued. Can we say that students' schools are doing better in the last, 13 years?
So I would say it's a mixed picture. Graduation rates are up. They're actually at an all-time high. The department actually just announced this morning. But scores on the National Assessment for Education Progress, which is the NAEP, the nation's report card, are actually a little bit down. So we're not really there's really a mixed picture, basically, of how No Child Left Behind, but also the Obama administration's waivers that I mentioned a few minutes ago, how those initiatives have impacted achievement. It's a very mixed picture.
And what about the dropout rate? Do we have figures on that?
On the graduation rate, we have all-time graduation highs. I don't have the I'm not exactly sure. I would assume that means a lower dropout rate as well.
Now, as you said, this is all very complicated. So then what happens to Common Core that's been so much in the news? And also the Obama administration's race to the top. Are they kaput, or are they something that states can also continue developing and using?
So Race to the Top was not included in ESSA, so that program is, as you said, more or less kaput. When it comes to Common Core, though, there's a lot of misconceptions out there about the Common Core, but it's not really a federal program. It's a program that was developed by the Council of Chief State School Officers and the National Governors Association that states could decide to opt into. They could decide to adopt these standards or not. The Obama administration really embraced the Common Core. And encourage states to sign on to it, first through Race to the Top and then through those waivers that I mentioned. So this law makes it really clear that the federal government can't do anything to encourage states to adopt any particular set of standards, including the Common Core. So the secretary is just really barred from interfering in that way. But that doesn't mean that states that are having a good experience with the Common Core can't continue with them. I mean, the bill would allow them certainly to continue embracing those standards.
Does this reduce the authority then of the Education Department?
Yes. This bill includes just a litany of prohibitions on the U.S. Secretary of Education when it comes to teacher evaluation, when it comes to school turnarounds, when it comes to standards. I mean, there's just a lot of language in the bill kind of trying to rein in the authority of the Education Department, in part because Congress thinks that the current Secretary of Education, U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, overreached by offering those waivers from No Child Left Behind.
So this is a repudiation of Arne Duncan? Can we say that?
I think that there's certainly some folks who would say that. It definitely, I would say, undercuts his legacy.
And what happens to pre-K? There's a lot of talk about getting kids into schools earlier. Does ESSA do something for pre-K?
Yes, ESSA does have, for the first time in ESEA, a new program for pre-K. It's called the Preschool Development Grant Program. I actually should say it's not totally brand new. It enshrines in law something that had already been funded through the budget. But when it was funded through the budget, it was just very popular in states. And over 24 states applied for one of these preschool development grants, and not all of them got one. So this will really help states expand their preschool offerings.
So when this goes into effect, which is what, 2017? 16?
Yes, 2017-18 will be the very first school year for ESSA, the end of this school year and next school year will be a transition from No Child Left Behind to ESSA.
And will students notice any difference? I mean, if you were to look at a classroom under ESSA, under No Child Left Behind, under Common Core, under Race to the Top, are we going to see something different when it's ESSA?
So I don't think you would walk into a school on the first day that ESSA is in effect and be able to see a major imprint suddenly from this new law. And I think a lot of it will, since so much of this new law is up to states, states can continue doing many of the same things that they were doing under No Child Left Behind and the waivers. It would just be more up to folks at the local level whether to continue with those things. So the question now going into ESSA implementation is how much change will states decide to embrace themselves? And once we know that, we'll have a better sense of what classrooms will look like in 2017-18.
Well, Allison Klein, thank you so much for joining us, getting our conversation started, helping us walk through the thicket of policies related to education in this country.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's a reporter for Education Week, covers federal policy in Congress, co-author of the blog Politics K-12. We're talking about ESSA. That's the Every Student Succeeds Act, just signed into law last week by President Obama. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In a rare show of bipartisanship last week, Congress passed and President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, to replace No Child Left Behind, the often criticized and often unpopular education law that was enacted back in 2002. Joining us now is David Kirp. He's the James D. Marver Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, author of Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System, and a Strategy for American Schools. He's also a contributing writer to the New York Times. And David Kirp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email. radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want your opinion on what we are talking about. David, you had a piece in the New York Times. One of the sentences read, "Good riddance to a misbegotten law." What was wrong with No Child Left Behind?
Well, the concept of No Child Left Behind, which is the core concept, which, to borrow a phrase from George Bush, the best phrase a speechwriter ever wrote, that you wanted to eliminate the soft bigotry of low expectations, was great. And the idea that you focus on kids who had been left behind was also great, but the way the law went about it was horrific. I mean, but it really got things backwards. It left 50 states to set standards, and then it opposed its own Procrustean strategy for pains and punishments for districts that didn't meet an arbitrary standard of promotion. And what happened across the country was disastrous. If I recall, Philadelphia is one of the many cities that had cheating scandals under No Child Left Behind. And the reason for that wasn't that school folks are bad people. It's that the standards that were set were impossible. They were too narrow. They focused teaching on a test that was a bad test. And they didn't provide the money that was supposed to be part of that legislation. I could go on, but that gives you a sense.
That certainly gives us a sense.
Otherwise, I love the law.
I hear you. I hear you. But I wonder, though, and the second sentence you ask is, will its replacement be any better? That's the question about whether ESSA will address some of the concerns that No Child Left Behind had and wasn't able to deal with. But do you have confidence that returning control and some responsibility back to the states will be an improvement? I'm thinking if I lived in Massachusetts, perhaps yes. If I lived in a different state where they don't seem to invest as much money in education, perhaps no.
Oh, I agree with that. And that's the reason for the question mark at the end of that sentence. We had one fight over accountability in Washington. We will have 50 fights in the states. And it's going to be important for advocates who are concerned about the groups whose needs are greatest in the school to push the districts and to push the state into paying attention to those kids. I mean, the reality is that that's always what winds up mattering.
Right.
At the end of the day, is what it is that happened on the ground and in the local level. And I'd rather leave it to the states, even though things may be worse in a handful of states that we can leave unnamed. But remember that, you know, you had 42 states signing on to the Common Core, which is a much more intelligent set of standards than existed under No Child Left Behind. They voluntarily did this. They planned it themselves. So what that suggests to me is that there really has been a turnaround in attitude about the role of the schools. And I think that will continue, but I don't think we can take for granted that it will continue.
Would it be fair to say that under No Child Left Behind, we saw in true numbers, maybe not complete numbers, the achievement gap, the disparity between schools in largely middle-class neighborhoods where they're able to spend a lot of money on their public schools and schools like a city of Philadelphia with 25% poverty rate where there's a much greater need but less money invested in education?
Did the disparity shrink? Well, the funds have always – so to offer up a bit of history, the legislation we're talking about goes back in 1965. It's the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It gets renamed from time to time, which is what happened beginning with No Child Left Behind and now continuing with Education, with Every Student Succeeds. The focus has always been on the kids who've been left behind, and the emphasis has always been to concentrate funds on those kids. In that sense, nothing has changed. Mm. What's changed is such things as identifying which groups are doing well and which groups aren't bad, doing badly, and what you do about it. Once upon a time, what you had was federal officials as effectively bean counters. They looked to see that the dollars were only spent on those kids. Nobody was paying any attention to education. In that sense, No Child Left Behind Act is progress because it did say, you know, we care about what kids are doing in school, not just whether they're getting the dollars. It's just that they asked the wrong questions about what kids should be doing in schools and found the wrong ways of enforcing those wrong goals.
Do you like the idea, this is under ESSA, the idea that, yes, students will be taking math and reading tests, but also things like engagement and attendance and some of these more relational aspects of education will be a factor in determining how a child is doing, how a teacher is doing? Does that seem fairer to you?
It's critically important. What happened under No Child Left Behind is that math and reading, because they were weighted so much, because they affected schools' fate and you know, under the waivers that Secretary Duncan offered, the effective teachers, those test results were so important, they drove out everything else. So what you don't find in many schools is the art and music and gym. Gym got shrunk to a period a week in many places. And the saddest part of that is that it's in the schools where kids are doing worse academically that the entire focus became a reading and math focus, and education became a joyless experience. I think that's one reason why test scores really didn't improve. It's the very metric that the law was supposed to address wasn't effective. That the nationwide test, the National Assessment Test, NAEP as it's called, those scores remained flat and indeed went down in some cases. Because you have kids who are really disaffected. My view of judging any school program is it something you'd want your own child or a child you love to experience? And I think that broadening the focus, which is what the new law does, to include, as you say, those relationship factors, those issues involving school climate, are kids engaged? Are teachers engaged in what's going on? Are kids happy? Are they motivated to learn? Those are critical additions to what's going on. They broaden the scope of what school should be about in ways that I think you and I and most of the people listening would agree are important.
Absolutely. I mean, the question is, and I don't think you'd get any disagreement about that, which is how do you create that in every, if I can say this, every classroom in every school across the country?
So the philosophy of No Child Left Behind was implicitly teachers are laggards and slugs. They're going to basically sort of show movies all the time, and what you really need to do is to beat them in shape. That's how I experience the teachers. When I spent a year in Union City, New Jersey, looking at everything from individual classrooms to the way the district operated, I didn't see any of that. What I saw was teachers, a lot of them good, some of them brilliant, really working their tails off on behalf of students. And I think what teachers need is encouragement. I don't think they respond particularly well to the whip. Indeed, you know, when Governor Christie was lashing out at them, you could feel the demoralization in the teacher's room. So teachers need help. And I hope the money gets used for things like coaching in class, which is known to be a very effective strategy. They want support. Teachers hate having other bad teachers in their school because they bring down morale. The good teachers care about the students. So the handful of teachers, and there really is a handful of teachers who shouldn't be in the profession, and they should be encouraged to leave the profession and pushed out of the profession if necessary. But most teachers need support, and that wasn't the philosophy of No Child Left Behind.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you again. That's David Kerp, the James D. Marver Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, author of a number of books, including Improbable Scholars, The Rebirth of a Great American School System, and A Strategy for America's Schools. He's a contributing writer to The New York Times, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a bill that got passed and signed by President Obama last week. You might not have known about it. It's now called Every Student Succeeds Act, replacing No Child Left Behind. And again, to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There's always a frustration that I have, David. I don't know if you have it as well, but it seems like, as you say, these policies and reform ideas go back to Lyndon Johnson, is we keep sort of reinventing. I mean, we know things about education, and the question is, you know, how do we make them happen? And it seems by shifting from the federal government to the states, from the states back to the federal government, do we really get closer to addressing what children need in the classroom?
I think that's a really core question. The essence of education is that you connect a talented teacher, a challenging curriculum, and an engaged student, and everything needs to be built out from there. And that isn't how policymakers talk about education. They basically are rewriting the systems and the structures and the incentives and the like. And those are important, but they're relatively much less important then doing what you can to boost both the teachers and the materials. A student who's not engaged is not going to learn. If there isn't some close personal relationship based on trust between kids and their teachers, it's a very hard time motivating kids to learn. If you think back to your own experience in school,
yep.
Those are the teachers that, right? Those are the teachers who matter. Those are the teachers who are still in your head. Those are the teachers who you work hardest for. They may very well be the reason that you're in the career you're in now, and, you know, not an astrophysicist or a,
clearly not,
you know, or a pro basketball player. So I absolutely, this is where things like coaching and support help. And I think the difference between now and 1965 is that that was an era in which the idea, you know, that minorities were entitled to anything, deserved any kind of support, was contentious in a way that it isn't today. And that's not to deny that discrimination continues to exist, but it is to say that, you know, again, the positive legacy of No Child Left Behind is that it has focused attention on the needs of those kids. It has gotten school districts to pay specific attention to the needs of those kids. And those needs aren't going away, particularly the English learners, the increasing part of the population. Many, many teachers go into the classroom totally unprepared to teach kids of one different language, let alone four, five, six languages, which is often the case in urban school districts. That's the kind of effort for which they need support. And again, if your attitude is that teachers need to be whipped in shape, you know, all this sounds very soft and mushy. If your attitude is that most teachers really want to do a fantastic job for their kids and they need and welcome support in doing it, again, from their peers, given time to collaborate, from folks who know the field, coming into their classrooms, teaching, watching, co-teaching with those teachers, giving them a kickstart in what they're doing, then I think the potential for the state to do well is great. But the real change is going to happen at the local level. It's going to happen at schools. It's going to happen in the classroom. And the best Washington can do and the best the state capitals can do is to support that effort.
An email from Joseph. See, he says, since parental participation is so important in a child's education, why not teach the parents how to help their children?
Absolutely. Parents have to be partners in this process. And that means, in many cases, overcoming a legacy of distrust where parents haven't been welcomed into the schools because teachers think of them as interfering and teachers haven't really known how to talk to parents without getting, you know, angry and frustrated and irate at what it is that's going on. There's a lot of learning to be done on both sides in that conversation, and that learning ought to happen because that relationship is key.
Philadelphia is looking at developing what they call community schools. They've looked at some of the other cities where a school building becomes more than just a bunch of classrooms, but it's a place where the people living in the community can come and have eyeglasses fitted or an eye exam or some kind of health care. Do you see that? If it's addressing some family community involvement, do you see that as a positive?
Absolutely. In a book I wrote called Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Improving Kids' Lives in America's Future, one of those big ideas is connecting schools and communities. The idea that kids are little, you know, intellectual machines and what you've got to do is to push knowledge into them, and that there ought to be, quote, no excuses for teachers' failure. It's derisory. All you've got to do is to walk in a school in a poor neighborhood and you see the problems, the health problems, the emotional problems, the community problems, the violence problems that those kids are trailing into them in with school. And schools are really sanctuaries for those kids, but the kinds of support you're describing are just key. A third of kids who are coming to school from urban school districts come with uncorrected vision problems. A third of them come with uncorrected dental problems, and I don't mean a cavity missed. We lose 1.5 million days of school to those problems, and about a third of the kids have uncorrected asthma. So think about it. You can't see the blackboard. You're in pain, and you're coughing. How well are you going to be able to focus on learning? So it's very important for the kids to have those services. It's important for parents as well, because real community schools provide parents with something that they need, whether it's English language instruction or citizenship preparation or whatever, computer literacy. What parents need ought to be part of that process as well. In New York City, the Children's Aid Society runs fantastic schools. I've visited several of them. They're where Kids First begins. And I remember talking to a well-off potential donor and her son, who went to one of the Tony Prep schools, and he looked around at what was going on. He saw that there was not only an eye doctor, but there was an orthodontist who'd come in to provide orthodontia for the kids. And he said, "I wish I had this in my school." Yes, I think, and this is also, by the way, where Newark is now going under Chris Cerf to focus on the South Ward schools to make them community schools. It's a really essential part of rebuilding American education.
And David, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, I guess the question is, and perhaps we'll find out the answer to it, which is, if states are in control, if they empower their school districts, if it's closer to where the children are living and learning, will they be able to address the achievement gap and make it for a rich and exciting school education experience?
I think if they make schools a rich and exciting educational experience, the achievement gap will shrink. And frankly, what we know from the data is those test scores matter a whole lot less than students being engaged and feeling emotionally secure and able to work and play well with others. I mean, do you remember your proficiency level in your ninth grade reading test? I sure don't.
I sure don't either. And yet, I guess what you're saying is that for some, it feels like that's sort of like a red letter, yeah?
Exactly. What you want is for kids to want to work and to want to learn. And all the kinds of supports we've been talking about, the community schools, the social-emotional development, social-emotional skills, those all connect up. It's not as though kids, there's something called cognitive and non-cognitive. They're two separate domains. They're connected in our lives. If kids feel good about themselves, they're going to learn.
David Krupp, thanks so much. Got to say goodbye. No, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. A third guest waiting in the wings talking more about education. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just a recap here. Last week, Congress passed and President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act to replace No Child Left Behind. That was a law enacted back in 2002. The new law gives more control, more responsibility to the states for educating their children. Our third guest now joins us, Connor Williams, senior researcher in education policy at New America, also taught first grade for a while. And Connor Williams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Are you with us, Connor?
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, no, that's great. Yeah, we just had a kind of fuzzy sound there. That's okay. I was reading, probably not your fault. I was reading some of the articles, the pieces that you've written about No Child Left Behind. And one of the things that you said after visiting a number of schools is that it's, quote, unquote, kind of working how?
So, you know, as I've been watching this happen, this play out, the new ESSA law in Congress, it's been an interesting position to be in. I am not a fan of No Child Left Behind. I think of myself as a good progressive. Don't generally believe in the law for a lot of reasons we can get into.
Sure.
But one of the things I have decided is that the reason that I found ESSA so frustrating as they've replaced No Child Left Behind is it seems to me like it's solving No Child Left Behind's problems in exactly the wrong direction, right? So here's what I mean by saying it's kind of working. We went around. I focus on English language learners as a professional matter. And so we were going from school to school, talking to different schools who serve really high populations of these students. And we kept hearing that, lo and behold, these supposedly draconian expectations in No Child Left Behind, these extraordinarily high standards, we heard a couple of things. One, that they were actually attainable, not just for these kids, for these English language learners, but broadly speaking, these were high and challenging, but definitely reachable standards for them. And then two, what we would hear is when these schools and a number of the ones we went to had been identified and in need of improvement or, there's lots of different ways to talk about it, but basically they were held accountable under No Child Left Behind. A lot of them took that pressure, that federal prompt basically to do something different and use that as a way to leverage changes that they needed in their school and in their district. So, does that mean that it worked every time, all the time around? I mean, these are anecdotal things. They're small n. But we do have some evidence on a larger scale that kind of federal pressure does provide state and local educators and stakeholders some cover to make big changes in schools and big changes that do matter for kids.
But are you saying that, states cannot shoulder that responsibility?
What I'm saying, and this is what I realized as I was doing this research, is, again, as a good progressive, I have nothing against state policymakers and legislators in particular. But as a group, I think there's a reason that all of the really successful federal or successful civil rights moves we've made as a country have been federal. When you narrow the political context for making a decision about civil rights, whether it be in education, whether it be about voting rights, whether it be about anything, at the state level, groups that are privileged, that are well-to-do, that have access to lots of resources, they have much more clout. And so any time that we kick decision-making down about underserved students, underserved children, or about underrepresented populations in voting, fill in the blank, any civil rights issue, when you kick that down to the state level, you're operating in that state political context in a way that makes it much harder to focus on the underserved.
Well, and I just a thought that crossed my mind, and I mentioned this with David Kerp, which is if I were a student or had a student, let's say in Massachusetts, as I understand, there's a, you know, kids do pretty well. There's a pretty universal investment in education there. And I'm also thinking in Texas, for instance, they're still debating about whether to teach evolution or not. Is that one of your fears, which is you'll get 50 different standards and models?
It definitely is. I mean, this is one of the things that I was realizing, right? If you're going to solve No Child Left Behind, you have to hit the real flaw. And in my mind, these are not actually flaws about overweening federal pressure. One of the major problems, and you know, David mentioned this, is that states under No Child Left Behind had a ton of room to still kind of monkey around with the system. They could set their own standards. They could, and did, by the way, right? They could use whatever assessment they felt like, no matter how useless it really was, no matter how demeaning or narrow or badly designed. They could set whatever the cut score they wanted for proficiency, meaning if they decided we're going to say 45% is adequately proficient in algebra this year, good enough. And so that meant that awful state school systems could look really good. You know, famously, you know, David didn't want to name names, but the famous example is that oftentimes Mississippi would show that it was doing outstanding with its students. It showed where they had huge proficiency numbers on math in high school. Massachusetts would not, and that's because Massachusetts was requiring just like leaps and bounds more of their students and holding them to a higher standard. So this law, ESSA, what it does is it says, all right, well, states had a lot of latitude under No Child Left Behind, far more than sort of the public opinion on No Child Left Behind realizes. Right. Let's give them more room to define who they want to focus on and how. I think that's a really bad decision.
And it sounds like, based on what you've been saying and also some of the things that you've written, and I think other people share this with you, which is that will the underserved children, how will they fare under ESSA? And will there be the kind of investment in their education that they deserve?
It's really hard to know at this point, in part because, and this is another one of the things, this hasn't come up yet, but in the sort of very narrow beltway education policy circuit, one of the weird things, and you see this in little quotes here and there on the coverage of the law, is that the various staffers on either side of the aisle don't agree on what the law actually says.
Oh,
there are
really
fundamental disagreements. Democratic staffers, Republican staffers disagree on whether or not the federal government can, in fact, step in under certain circumstances to actually force states to move more aggressively on behalf of the underserved, which is one of those things to say that it might be a great law if in fact, the forces, the civil rights forces, folks who care deeply about the underserved, win the right court cases, we might be okay. If they don't, who knows? I mean, so this is one of the problems. If your compromise law is so vague in its language that people aren't entirely sure what it means, you're not setting up a particularly effective strategy or theory of action for improving American education, especially for the kids who need it most.
Now, as I understand it, the way it's written, but perhaps it's vaguer than this, that something like states either should or must intervene to the 5% of schools that are underperformers.
Right. And it gets complicated because under No Child Left Behind, whatever else is wrong with it, the percentages and the metrics we were using to measure them were reasonably defined. The feds wanted to at least set some standards around how many kids had to be reaching proficiency by what point. And again, proficiency was state defined, so that meant states could still game the system. But now that 5% means states still have room to define a lot of issues around proficiency, and they're adding actually a growth metric, which is a pretty good thing, right? So maybe a kid makes 3 years of reading growth in 1 year, but they're still behind somehow, then states can give schools credit for that. But there's all sorts of other things they've jammed into there. You know, there are five indicators within the accountability system, one of which can account for up to 49% of the state's design for its own accountability system. That 49% could be, again, you've mentioned it already, things like school climate surveys, student engagement measures. I mean, by my read of it, as long as you can disaggregate it by different groups of students, as long as whatever data you're collecting to measure that 49%, you can do anything. So you could say the number of students participating in extracurriculars on site. That could be an enormous part of how you determine whether a school is succeeding or not. To my mind, that's a concern.
Well, and the testing or over-testing associated with No Child Left Behind, do you think all that testing was an overreaction to No Child Left Behind or trying to address the kind of pressure that districts felt to have their children perform?
I mean, it's one of those ones where I have my own view of it, but the data are pretty contested. I mean, there's something in the neighborhood. It's like 17 tests, I think, are officially mandated across an entire kids from, you know, the beginning to the end of their K-12 experience. There are 17 tests mandated in No Child Left Behind, which that means, you know, on a sort of across the entirety of a kid's education is not a particularly large number. That said, you know, we have lots of other tests that have sort of spawned off of that, that have spun off of that. In part, we had state policymakers who were mimicking what was happening in No Child Left Behind. They were adding tests because a sort of test as metric for achievement and that became popular under No Child Left Behind. So you had states doing the same thing. But I think it's pretty hard to argue that the over-testing challenges in the United States are actually a result of No Child Left Behind. We have good data. So in Ohio, actually, I've seen study, right? In Ohio, they did a check, and about a third of the tests in Ohio were from No Child Left Behind. The remaining two-thirds were state or local ones that other folks had added on. You know, does that mean that No Child Left Behind is to blame for those two? I doubt it. It's one of those things where it's more like they got tried in the court of public opinion and they lost No Child Left Behind, you know, legislators and supporters. And I don't think they'll ever turn back the rhetoric on that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Connor Williams, senior researcher in education policy at New America. You taught first grade. I have that right, don't I, Connor?
Yes, that's right.
How many years and where?
I taught for a couple years in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, in a I mean, it's a part of the neighborhood famous mostly for race riots, sadly, that the ones that actually ended David Dinkins' mayoralty.
Oh, goodness. Yes, I remember that well. Let me give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We're talking about education policy and the fact that last week Congress passed, President Obama signed Every Student Succeeds Act to replace No Child Left Behind. Let me read a couple of tweets here. Email actually from Linda says, please bring up the key to education success, small classes. Is that true, Connor?
You know, I don't know the literature on small class size as an expert. I know it as a, you know, an amateur who works in education. My understanding is that it is true. Think of it this way. A class size of one would have certain effects for certain students. A class size of three would have some other effects for other students. A class size of 11, a class size of 19, depending on subject, depending on students, depending on context, there are times, yes, where smaller classes make a difference. And there's no question about that. That said, one of the things that's useful to remind people like me, right, who good progressive, think as a progressive educator, you know, the Montessori model, for instance, uses enormous class sizes, in part because one of the premises of the model is that students ought to have a great deal of independent time. They shouldn't be relying on the adult in the room to drive their education for them. And that's just to say that it is not true that as a first premise that we must have a class size of a certain number to get effective education. It is true that in specific contexts, moving from 29 kids down to 24 could make a big difference. Or that in other contexts, moving from 25 down to 18 could really matter. But it just varies a ton.
An email from Martha where she says, I think if our nation is really committed to good education for all children, we should provide the funds through taxes or whatever to reduce class size. But I think it's also true, Connor, which is because school districts are largely funded by property taxes. You live in a fancy area. You got, you know, fancy houses, you're going to have more money to spend on education. Does any of this, did No Child Left Behind deal with that? Does ESSA deal with that?
So a few things. First of all, just a quick pitch. If I were going to spend more money on education, and I'm for that, I would love to – every additional dollar I add to what we spend on education, and frankly, I would take some of the existing dollars and move them around to this, would be to raising teacher salaries by far. I mean, that would be where I'd start, period. That's much more important, I think, than the size of classes or any number of other things we spend money on.
Do you think you'd get better teachers or better teaching out of that, or they just deserve to be paid more?
I think that you would help to professionalize the teaching force. You'd help to start attracting lots of people to teaching who might not otherwise consider it. I also think that our current teaching force, again, as David was saying, doesn't get enough credit and definitely deserves more money than they're getting. But the reason I think that is that we should spend more on teacher salaries is that I think there are two really big theories of how you improve American schools, and No Child Left Behind is pushing on one of them, which is that we've got this really screwy governance system where there's lots of local control and local and state control that often make it hard to get resources and attention paid to underserved kids. We have this federal system where you send some money to the state to send it to districts, to send it to schools, and hopefully it shows up in a classroom in a way, and there's little levers along the way, et cetera, et cetera. That accountability sort of strategy is one way to improve education. I'm not opposed to it on its face. I think it works okay. But the other way to do it is to really invest heavily in the teacher capital pipeline, getting more people, good people, into the teaching profession and improving the folks we have there. I think that's a really important thing to do as well. It's a different kind of debate, but I think raising salaries would help get us there. So your other question was about whether NCLB had anything to do with this. I mean, what yes. I've heard is that the rules in every iteration of this law, the Elementary and Secondary Education Elementary and Secondary Education Act, up through No Child Left Behind and since, have this provision called supplement, not supplant, meaning you're not supposed to be able to use the federal dollars to just cut your local funding for schools. You have to keep funding it and then supplement these dollars on. No Child Left Behind's language for doing this was a little bit tighter than the ESSA language, as I understand it. And that's to say there is some concern, and I've had some consultants gleeful about this, actually, telling me, education consultants who say they believe that the language in ESSA will make it much easier for them to justify getting Title I dollars to spend on any number of things that don't always go directly to Title I schools. I haven't been able to prove that as a matter of looking at the legislative text. It seems like it's right to me, but it's worrisome for sure.
Unfortunately, we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation, and we have absolutely no time here. A quick comment from Joe says, I think one of the criticisms of education is that bad teachers are not released. We've done whole hours on that. But is that in your hierarchy of concerns, is that a big one for you, Connor?
I think that that's a subset of the problem, which is to say that the reason you want federal pressure is to make uncomfortable changes possible at the state and local levels. Sometimes that means replacing teachers. It doesn't always mean replacing teachers. And that's to say that you want to make sure that when changes happen, that they're meaningful. Under NCLB and certainly under ESSA, that's not going to be the case.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Connor Williams, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Senior researcher in education policy at New America, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. As we talked about ESSA, that's the new law, Every Student Succeeds Act, signed into law last week. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can figure out how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.